this is Angela Middleton, and welcome to my podcast called I Want to BA. The reason for this podcast is that there is a huge lack of careers advice in the UK, and I'm always asked by young people, by parents and by teachers, my views on improving careers advice, and particularly by parents, what should they say to their youngster who's leaving school. I think it is a wider subject. It's not just about what job do you want to do, but it is actually about how you want your life to be, and within that, what type of career you want to select. And that career can just be the first stepping stone. Nowadays, individuals have a whole portfolio of careers. The people that I've interviewed, even at the age of 30, have had four or five careers. Myself, I've had at least five different types of careers. So this podcast is about firstly talking about careers in general and careers advice, but secondly, bringing in individuals who have experienced careers in particular industries, hence the subject I Want to BA, and they can come and talk about the path that they took to actually get to where they are, and also talk about what it's like to actually do that job and have that career. So we'll be covering every type of career that we can think of in the UK, and it will be everything from architects to zoologists. So I'll look forward to comments, and we'll build things up as we go along, and hopefully it should be of great use to parents, to teachers and to young people.
Angela, you're on the other side of the chair now.
No, so very strange.
Talking about your career. So Tell me about Angela Murray, as was your school days. What was Angela Murray, the schoolgirl, like?
So I think I was quite fearful and quite shy. I was one of three children, two brothers, and quite a traditional old school family where the boys were the loud ones and the girls were the quiet ones. And although I was the oldest child, I very much felt that I had to sort of mind my P's and Q's, be a good girl, and consequently wasn't hugely confident. And so when I went to school, I was probably the quiet one, and I used to often find myself thinking, you know, in class, I knew that answer, I should have answered it.
But so you were afraid. A bright girl, you were an intelligent girl, you know, did well at primary school exams.
I didn't know at that point, really. I wasn't sure. I think, you know, you didn't, I didn't really know that until the 11 plus. In junior school, I was, I understood everything and sort of kept up, but I wasn't really aware of how academic I was at that point. So, yeah, I was quite shy and quite fearful, I think. And it really wasn't until I got GCSEs that I surprised myself that maybe I was
but you had a journey before you got to GCSEs, because that talent wasn't immediately spotted in you when you went to school, was it?
No, so when I went to pretty rough schools in South London, mm-hmm. and one of them was a comprehensive, and when we went there the first day, you all sat there cross-legged waiting to be called out to join your class. And so I'm sitting there cross-legged, and they called all the names out, and in the end, probably my worst nightmare, you know, at the end of it, was there were about three of us left sitting there, and the teacher sort of looked and said, you're not on any of the lists, so you better come with me then. So off we went, and I landed up in a class which was actually for the naughty children, the F stream.
Right.
F for failure, I think it would be. And I mean, it was a pretty scary experience, because I remember sort of sitting there and everybody's jumping up and down on tables and throwing things and fights and swearing. And I don't know how long that went on for, but I remember...
That would have been pretty miserable for you.
Yeah, and I remember sort of sitting there, you know, all sort of with my uniform all buttoned up nicely, and sitting there looking at the teacher, the male teacher, Mr. Andrews, who was an English teacher. And he suddenly looked at me and he said, "I think you're in the wrong class." And I said, "Yeah, I think I might be." And he said, "Okay, come with me." And he took me to another class, which turned out to be the A stream. And that's where I stayed. And that's therefore where I flourished.
And would you say then that he plays an important part in your life story then?
Yeah, well, talking to you now, I've sort of recognised that he did. Mm. I don't think probably I realised that at the time. He certainly noticed the potential. And then... you know, I sort of flourished in that A stream, got good GCSEs, stayed for A levels. And then there was another notable moment where there was a teacher, and I always remember her in the corridor. I could see her now. And she said to me, "Have you considered university? I really think you should go to university." And she talked about the fact that she'd gone to Leeds and studied English literature. And I remember thinking, my goodness, I'm not moving out of London and going to this big red brick building up north. No, definitely I don't want to do that.
So it wasn't the studying so much. It was the move to... an alien part of the country.
Yeah, I didn't know anybody who'd gone to university. I don't think I'd ever travelled out of London. And, you know, as far as I was concerned, my dad had always drummed into me that you work really hard at school and then you'll get a good job. So my mission was to get those A-levels and to get this good job. And for me, I didn't really know what a good job was, except for it obviously had to be in a big company.
Well, that's interesting. So tell us more about how you identified a big company.
So I thought, well, I want to work for the largest company in the UK. There was no Google or anything then. So I just guessed that, you know, if it had British at the front of the name, then it must be quite big. So
quite,
I applied
quite a reasonable
to,
assumption,
yeah, so
it, really?
I applied to British Telecom, British Airways and British Petroleum. And I got a job as an A-level entrant in BP. And
not British Home Stores then?
Not British, I know, because that's the other thing. My dad actually said to me, and if you don't work hard, you will end up working for Woolworths.
Oh, okay.
So that was the sort of the other end of the scale. So there was no way that I would have gone into retail because of the way that, you know, the picture was painted for me. So I joined BP. I walked in the first day in the purchasing department, and it was a horseshoe of men, number of different, all guys responsible for buying different things for BP oil. So, you know, you had Peter Evans, who was in charge of all the packaging. And then you had Simon Green in charge of everything on the retail forecourt. And there was little me, no computers or anything. I was responsible for writing up all the orders. And we were spending, literally, as you can imagine, hundreds of thousands of pounds. And I remember walking in there the first day and wearing what was my best outfit, which was a pair of lovely pink trousers and a pink top, and quickly realising that's not what you wear to the office. So I'd not had any of that input or advice as to, you know, how to conduct yourself in an office.
But you learned a lot. Okay, I've got the picture of that environment, that male environment, but you also learned a lot from them in terms of politics and office etiquette and things like that, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was in the 80s, and so money was no object, really. We went out for very flamboyant lunches, dinners. There was a lot of socialising because obviously they were in the purchasing department, so they were taken out by suppliers as well, and I used to join in. And, yeah, so I used to, for the very first time, I saw that you would go to some restaurants where there would be five knives and forks. So I'd be thinking, my goodness, you know, what do I do here and what do I eat first? And so I was pretty good at sort of watching what was going on and just sort of copying that. So I quickly learned the etiquette in restaurants, and they used to have political discussions. I would not have a clue what they were talking about, but then I'd sort of go home, read the newspapers, watch the news and have something to say the next day. So I was sort of self-taught in that respect. And I was one of these that...
So it was a good education.
Yeah, it was.
In the workplace for you, really.
Yeah, very much.
But you then had that realisation that if not university was good for you, a degree would be good for you. So you then decided to take up a degree option, didn't you, at BP?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have been that nervous, you know, or a little flower, because I do remember looking at the internal vacancies and they all asked for degrees. And I thought, if I want to get on, and I do, then I'm going to need to get a degree. And so I went to see the head of HR and I asked if I could be transitioned onto this program that they were running, which was what they called a sandwich course. And you could go and do a business degree, 6 months at work, 6 months at college for 4 years. And you could either do it in London or in Portsmouth. And they said yes. And so I got accepted onto that course and I went to Ealing College, which is now the West.
So you still
London
didn't want to move to Portsmouth,
no,
did you?
No, definitely not. I was definitely London through and through. So I moved to Chiswick in West London and I went to college there for 4 years and, you know, sort of had the best of both worlds, really, because I was earning money the whole time. I suppose it's a bit like a degree apprenticeship now.
Yeah, that's what I thought when you mentioned it,
And during that time, I went to, I was in a whole variety of different departments at BP, so got really good business grounding.
But you realised you had an aptitude for selling as well, though, didn't you?
Yeah, so after I got my degree, I went back into BP as a graduate entrant. Firstly, helping to put together an IT system for sales reps. I then was given a company car and travelled all around the country teaching these sales reps how to use the system. Again, it was all guys. And then I was given the opportunity to be a sales rep myself. And this was selling fuel oil and bitumen products in London and the Southeast. And I actually became the top performing salesperson. And I do think that was a big advantage being a woman, because I was able easily to get appointments with transport managers, but also I had an eye for detail. I was able to always explain why the client ought to buy from us instead of anybody else. I had no fear of the phone. So I was, you know, doing hundreds of sales calls. I always felt even then that a no meant just not yet. I did loads of e-shots.
But this is a complete change from that girl at school, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who wouldn't put her hand up in class.
Yeah, it was really strange. I think every time I achieved something...
The confidence was built.
Yeah, there was a recognition that I had a bit more ability and that I certainly could sort of hold my own amongst my peers and probably was a bit better in some respects. And so that then propelled me to do the next thing. And although, and I suppose I was very used to feeling fear. Mm. I was used to it. Mm. And so from a young age. And so because of that, I suppose I was able to cope with it more. And so pushing myself out of my comfort zone was not a big deal because I always felt fearful.
But along came a move again, and you would have had to have gone with BP to their new offices in a different part of London.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mind, you know, during the time I was at BP, I worked all around the country, I worked across Europe as well, and I actually liked that. But they then moved out of London to Hemel Hempstead, and I really didn't want to go and work there. And at that time, in order to get maternity leave, you had to work for a company for 2 years. And so I had my eye, I was always very strategic, even to do with my personal life. I knew that I wanted to have children. I knew exactly the year I wanted to have children, how old I was going to be. So I thought, right, I'm going to change jobs now so that I end up with 2 years working for that company so that I get maternity leave.
Up to now, I mean, your career is being planned by you. It seems meticulous by you. Right, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Then I'm going to do this. Mm. And so that brought you to Bexley Heath, didn't it? Because your next stop was the Woolwich Equitable Building Society. Mm. And you found yourself there working as a systems analyst. So not sales.
No, you know, I'd worked up to quite a high level at BP. I was on the fast track management path and everything. But I'd sort of assessed that I wanted to do this next thing. I wanted to have children. And I got this job in Bexley Heath. It was a step down. But I was really confident that I'd be able to work my way up again. I don't remember being at all bothered about it. I thought, there's no travel. That will be great for me when I have children. So I took that job with a full intention of working my way up. And that's what I did.
So do you think that, would your advice be, don't be frightened of stepping backwards to go up again?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes you do have to either go sideways or down
to go
in a different direction.
Yeah, I never remember feeling, oh my goodness, what will people think or anything like that. I just was very much on a mission. You know, that's what I wanted to
focused.
Do.
Focused.
And that's what I did. Yeah. I was really focused. Yeah. It didn't feel like it at the time, but looking back, I definitely was.
Yeah.
And to cut a long story short, I was there for 10 years, during which time I had two children, had maternity leave, worked my way up, ended up at the end of that 10-year period managing a big department of 200 people, reporting to board level, and really feeling that it was well within my capabilities to get, you know, to sort of C-suite, CEO, whatever, but just really not wanting to.
Well, I was going to say, you had a bit of a light bulb in that you felt, actually, I don't want to emulate any of my bosses.
No.
And that was a strong feeling at that time, was it?
Yeah, and I think I said to you, you know, I always had this dislike of authority and feeling constrained and lack of independence. I'm like it now. I like to be able to sort of follow my own thoughts and do what I want to do. And I could see that even, you know, at that level, other people would be pulling your strings, and I just don't like that feeling.
So you gave it up?
And so, yeah, I mean, it was billed as my retirement, and they all found it hilarious that I said that I'm just leaving. But it was just after 2000. I'd hired lots of consultants. They were on about £1,000 a day or 1.5 a day. And I just knew that I'd be able to go back and do that. I had every confidence. Also, I'd now by that time been running a business with my husband for a long time.
But you were running two businesses, essentially. Yeah. You were having your career, but also helping your husband, Steve, with the construction business.
Yeah, doing all the operations for that. And that had proven to be very successful and very lucrative. So financially, I didn't really need to work, to be quite frank. I hadn't for quite a few years, although I'd really wanted to. And so, yeah, I just decided, right, I'm going to leave now, and I'm going to set up something which is completely mine, which, you know, I can sort of send in whatever direction I feel is right.
And that was going to be a shoe shop.
And that was going to be a shoe. Well, it would have been a chain of shoe shops.
Okay, of course, Angela, a chain, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I loved fashion, I still do, and I could see that there was potential online, and I was going to set up this this shoe business with somebody else. It required a large investment. I went ahead, did all the investigation, went to Milan, selected the range, found the designers, the distributors, went to take a lease out, didn't quite sign the bottom line. At the last minute, the lady I was going to do it with pulled out, it meant that I'd have to invest 100,000. I was only prepared to invest 50,000. And so I thought, well, okay, well, I'll look for another business opportunity. So at that point, it was going to be a business, any business. I wasn't sure what.
But your own business.
But my own business, yeah.
And I suppose that's a lesson that, you know, don't be fixated on one product and service that's what you want to sell. Because
absolutely.
If that doesn't work out, well, then apply yourself somewhere else.
Completely,
And you then had another light bulb moment on holiday in Dubai when recruitment came into your life, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just funny. You have to be open to opportunities. And what happened was I was just in Dubai. I saw a friend's photograph on the wall, asked her about this group of ladies who looked like they were having huge fun. She mentioned the fact that it was one of her friends who'd come over from the UK, who was a recruiter, has established her own recruitment business. Said how well it was going. I thought about it. I thought, do you know, I could really do that. I know about IT. I've got a big network of
and your sister-in-law
clients.
Was in recruitment, wasn't she?
And my sister-in-law had left Reed Employment. She'd had a new baby. She wanted to go back part-time. And I just said to her, look, I'll set this business up. You can work for me 3 days a week. And the idea was she'd work 3 days and I'd work 3 days. But, you know, that's not what happened, because the minute I started it, I was all over it, looking at best practice. I was doing it, you know, 24/7, and really quickly grew it as a recruitment business.
And then in 2011, you were attending a Boris Johnson presentation on apprenticeships.
Yeah.
And again, the light bulb went off, I suppose, did it?
Completely. Again, it's really, we don't realise at the time, pivotal moments. It's only what I think when you look back.
Yeah.
We'd been through a recession. It'd been a bit of a nightmare scenario. I'd learned a lot, but it meant that I was looking for diversification opportunities everywhere. And I went to this, someone, had, you know, we'd always had an affinity with young people, placing young people. And I went on this conference and Boris Johnson announced apprenticeships. And I just thought, this completely matches our skill set. So I went straight back, and I do act really fast. I literally
immediately you went back and launched. You had
went
a cohort
straight back
in,
and I
in
said,
the office, didn't
said
you?
To the team, you know, get me a cohort of young people. Let's put together, let's formalise what we're teaching anyway. Let's recruit some people that know how to deliver apprenticeships. All of our client base are going to be interested in this. Let's start selling it. And I just knew.
Yeah.
I knew straight away.
And the growth of Middleton Murray, because you've now got 14 branches and some virtual branches, is on the back of apprenticeships, really, isn't it?
The minute that I went niche and the minute that I started doing something that I really felt passionately, I really felt was very, very important, not just to me, but not just to the business, not just to the staff, but to the country. I just knew that it was so important.
You identified
important.
A need and you could fulfill that need.
That's right.
And so Middleton Murray, you also developed something which you sort of lead and everyone signs off on is your Gimsfort.
Well,
how do you pronounce it?
Yeah, I call it Gimsfort. Yeah. I mean, I basically came up with an anagram which represents a framework, really, for looking at any business opportunity. And it stands for growth, innovation, marketing, sales, finance, optimization, raving fans and trust. And I made this up. And as you know, we patented it and I set a business up called that. Because, you know, if you use that framework for any business idea, you can immediately start to assess whether it's going to be successful or not.
Okay, you've now got 150 staff. As I said, you're in 14 locations and you want to take it nationally. And you've also opened a branch in San Francisco, haven't you? So what's next for Middleton Murray?
So for Middleton Murray, I think that, you know, we've got a very highly replicatable system now. We are making a huge difference. We can make a much bigger difference in the UK. You know, ultimately, it's for the country and increasing productivity. But, you know, a part of that is helping youngsters, helping the people that they are working with, you know, their communities, their families. Just sort of, I love seeing people recognize their own potential
and developing it
and making their own difference. And I just, you know, if we can be responsible for that on a bigger scale, then great. And I'd love to take that globally as well.
And for Angela herself?
I am very keen on looking more holistically at people's potential. The health and fitness aspects, the mental health as well as the physical health. I really strongly believe that if you get that in order, then really there's nothing that you can't do. I've never really made too much of hurdles that I've encountered. And it really frustrates me when I see people sort of being stopped in their tracks because of perceived hurdles. So one of those hurdles tends to be mental and physical health. So we need to get that sorted and then work on their mindset so that they can fulfill their potential.
And if people listening to this who are in that office environment who are thinking, this has taken me as far as it can go.
Yeah.
I'm seeing my bosses and I don't want to emulate them. Mm. What would be your advice to them be?
Well, I mean, obviously there's financial constraints. So people may well feel that I'd love to leave, but I can't because I can't start from scratch.
Yeah.
So certainly there's potential for people to start businesses afterwards. So carry on doing the job that they're doing, but start to think about business ideas and see what they can do outside
of
their
hours. But
you
carried on two jobs. So would you recommend that to people if they can? Mm. If you work hard at something, eventually it gets easier, doesn't
it? Yeah, exactly. And I think that often people think, well, I don't have time. You know, I'm too busy, I'm too tired. But they do, everyone has the same amount of time. They've all got 24 hours. And it's a mindset. You know, some people can think, well, I'm tired and busy. And so consequently, I deserve to sit in front of the TV. Whereas other people may think,
that's not enough for me.
Actually, I am tired and busy, but this other thing that I want to do tonight is going to wake me up and ignite my passion and make me want to do more. And so if you do want to do something, it's all a question of how badly you want it. Because if you do want things to happen, then you can make them happen. And, you know, we've all got time somewhere and we've all got the ability to prioritise. We can't all do everything. So you have to make some hard choices sometimes about prioritising what's important to you.
Yep.
And the other thing that I would say is that if you are in a job that you don't like, you want to start your own business, but you don't have the experience, well, then the first thing you could do is to change your job and get closer to the area that you're keen on. So change your job in a sector and get some experience there, you know, and all the time be working on this new venture in the background. Maybe it's online or whatever it is. But, you know, sometimes people are in such a rush to get stuff done. And we've all got so much time, you know, God willing, as long as we stay fit and healthy, that it doesn't matter if, you know, it might take you 2 years to get something off the ground.
And what would you tell that little girl who wouldn't put her hand up in school?
I probably would say, please don't worry so much, you know.
Mm.
But I think, you found enough confidence to overcome the hurdles one at a time. That was all right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.